Homeless families trying to get a footing in Seattle have a new toehold. Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. There is an old hotel, an old travel lodge in South Lake Union. Amazon owns the land, plans to develop it. But for now, they have offered the space rent-free for a year to Mary's Place, a local service provider for homeless families. New York Times Seattle Bureau Chief Kirk Johnson went to that shelter, called the Guest Rooms, to report on some of the people living in this remarkable location.
We think of homeless shelters, I think, as being kind of in the Skid Row areas or in tent cities on the edge where nobody wants to be. But this is a place that is one of the most dynamic corners of the city, where wealth is being created and tech is exploding and buildings are going up. And in the middle of that, a homeless shelter, one of the largest in the city, is created. And I think that just creates an opportunity to look at this issue in a different light, because it's just in a different place. And that was a big part of why I wanted to go there.
What kind of person lives in Mary's Place guest rooms in South Lake Union?
It's all families. Unlike some shelters that are for single men or women, children are everywhere here. So that creates its own significant, huge dynamic of little kids and teenagers and families of all sorts that are running around. So it's specifically, from the start, I think, a different kind of shelter. Every step you take, you're gonna see kids, and it makes a difference.
Who did you talk to at the guest rooms who gave you a sense of what leads people to be there?
I was struck by the diversity. Photographer and I spent time with four families, none of whom had been in the Seattle area longer than about 6 to 8 months, I believe. One had come from Las Vegas. One had come from the Washington coast. And they all had really strikingly different and interesting stories of their paths that had led them here. A couple of them specifically coming for economic opportunity. They kind of looked at the map and said, Seattle is a place on the make, and there are going to be jobs here that we can get.
Sure.
And, yeah.
Did the people you talked to reflect on what it's like to have come here for boom times, end up with a bust, and live in such a hub of activity, hub of commercial activity?
Yeah, I think they were struck by that, and I asked them specifically about the wealth that was being created around them and how did that make them feel. And the answer that one guy gave me that really struck me powerfully was, he said, I don't have any trouble with people making their money. I never got a job from a poor man in my life. The people who are making money are putting money into the ground in construction, and I'm qualified for those jobs.
Is there a couple, a child that you met at the guest rooms that you're thinking of?
Well, I think this, of the stories I heard, one of them that really most powerfully affected me was a father who had been sort of estranged from the mother of his kids, living up in Everett, and seeing them but not being, you know, responsible on a day-to-day basis for their lives. And she kind of left town. She decamped and sent him a message saying, you know, they're yours now. So he showed up, and he had a 7-year-old and a 14-year-old, and he was ferociously determined to provide for them, but was you know, up to his eyeballs in difficulty. He had reached the point where he had to panhandle a couple times, and it just destroyed him. He hated it so much, and just filled him with a kind of terror, because he said, I'm a shy guy, and I to stand there and ask people, just, it was more than he could deal with. And his children, you know, I think the feeling I left with those kids was, they've got somebody solid in their lives now, you know. And that's a powerful thing. I mean, he was determined to go nowhere and to do what he could.
Kirk, what surprised you about your visit to the guest rooms?
I think I expected to hear more stories of frustration, of sort of hitting the wall, of unhappiness with society, or being sort of let down by society, or that the game was rigged, as we hear in politics or whatever. And I didn't hear that, and that really affected me and struck me that as much as these families had struggled and had had issues of whatever kinds internally that had contributed to where they were optimistic. I think that was the powerful thing. I mean, they believed that there was a path ahead and that it was going to be better than where they were.
Yeah, it's not just hopelessness and desperation. They see themselves as part of the system.
Definitely so. Definitely not just here we are wallowing in what society has done. That we are part of a society and part of a city that is going somewhere, and we can perhaps go along for the ride.
With risk and difficulty and hopefully success.
Right, right. No guarantees on any of it. But there's definitely a sense that they were on a journey rather than at the end of the road.
New York Times Seattle Bureau Chief Kirk Johnson there, and we're tweeting out a link to his story about the families who've moved into the guest rooms, the homeless shelter that just opened in South Lake Union in a former travel lodge. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke. Is Washington going to be the next state to step into the national fight over who gets to use what bathroom? You might already have been asked to sign a petition to get Initiative 1515 on your fall ballot. It says that if you need to use a public restroom or changing room or locker room, you'll have to use the one based on the sex you were assigned at birth, not the gender you identify with. Opponents say if you're a transgender person, that creates a situation that's discriminatory and even dangerous. News analyst Joni Balter says all of this reminds her of another recent Washington ballot fight.
It's reminded me of the 2012 Referendum 74 gay marriage debate.
How so?
Because there was a moment there somewhere like around the summer of 2012, before the November ballot issue, where there were so many business leaders and businesses in our state lining up to say that gay marriage should be the law of the land, that it felt like the issue had become mainstreamed, that there were powerful interests standing up for fairness in Washington state. 1515 reminds me of that, because we're starting to see some of the names of some of the businesses that will be fighting this measure to change what is a fairly simple rule in Washington state. And the rule is that folks can go to the bathroom of the gender they identify with instead of the biological gender.
Which businesses are these and what are they saying?
So some of the businesses that have already signed on: Microsoft, Google, Vulcan, the Greater Seattle Chamber of Commerce, are standing up to say that they do not want Washington to follow in the path of other states that are getting hung up on this bathroom issue. So there was a letter that was written by more than 100 companies to North Carolina, and it was signed by, well, lots of folks, but for your interest, the Starbucks CEO, the REI CEO. Folks here do not want to follow that path.
We've seen North Carolina get boycotted over this law. Washington State and Seattle saying, we're not going to travel on official business. Would Washington State get boycotted over 1515, do you think?
Absolutely, if it passed. But I think we should also talk about whether it's likely that it would pass. And that's something I've been thinking about. So you look at the November election. Who's the electorate? I was talking to this longtime political consultant, and he was predicting a Hillary Trump of 60-40, maybe even 65-35.
because liberals are going to turn out in November to vote for Hillary or against Trump. That's who's going to be voting
on this. That's who's going to be voting. So how do you get enough people to support this? I think it's a tough call, especially, as I'm saying here, with all these businesses coming out and saying, this is bad for business, this is bad for employees, this is bad for Washington State. We have tourism industry. We have so many tech firms here that have already expressed their dismay with North Carolina.
So you're not just in a Seattle bubble, are you? You're saying statewide this thing does not pass in November.
I'm saying that because of the preponderance of business that has lined up and will line up mainstreaming this issue. Now, to be fair, in 2012, one of the things that turned the tide was the fact that everybody had a cousin, a friend, or somebody who was in a gay relationship, and all they could do is think it was a loving relationship. Why not support it? It is a little bit more of a reach to say, you know, that you know a transgender person and therefore all issues, all worries about what happens in bathrooms are calmed. But I still think this is the ethics of the state of Washington. You know, LGBT, we're working on the T right now.
News analyst Joni Balter will watch right along with you. Thank you.
And thank you.
Supporters of Initiative 1515 are gathering signatures right now, so by July, you'll know whether you'll be voting on this in November. And right now, we are tweeting out a link to a previous discussion we've had here on KUOW on this transgender bathroom issue. We're tweeting at KUOW. Yes, we'll be telling you about the Republican primaries in West Virginia and Nebraska and reporting on the whole presidential election here on KUOW. Here's what the election looks like in these parts in Washington State. Jermaine J. Cornegay is running to be a Hillary Clinton delegate. She wants to go to the national convention this summer. In 2013, she was elected to the Cedro Woolley City Council, the first and only African American to hold office in that city's 115-year history. KUOW's David Hyde has her story.
Back when Jermaine Cornegay ran for office and she campaigned door to door,
I was invited in for soup, for dinner, for tea, ask questions.
Almost everyone she met and everything she experienced was pretty great, except this one time.
He stepped out on the porch, maybe about 4 inches from my face, and I watched his wife looking out of the window. And the first thing out of his mouth was, "I will never vote for you because you're black." That's the first thing he said to me. I just said to myself that I'm really going to learn something from this man. I'm going to sit here and listen, and I'm going to learn from it, and then I'm going to use it to motivate myself to win this election. And he went on for a good 10 minutes about how African Americans can never do anything good, and he even finished off by saying that I wish you'd go back where you came from. And all I could think is I would love to go to Africa, but I'd love a round trip ticket too.
Why did you decide to stand there and just listen to that?
Because he himself during the conversation admitted that he hated being a bigot. He hated that about himself. And I thought that it was extremely telling that he was being so honest. And I much prefer someone being that honest with me than someone that's doing it behind my back. And I learned a lot from him, actually. I learned a lot. Now, me and him have mutual friends. And those friends have told me that he really appreciated that I listened to him and heard him out. And that he wished he hadn't done that. And he was really embarrassed. I mean, so I feel like that's kind of the way you change people's minds is you have to let them get to know you. You can't run away from it.
That story makes me curious to know more about Cedro Woolley. How many African Americans serve on your city council?
None, except for this one. I didn't realize that when I was running that I was going to be the first person of color ever elected in Cedro Woolley's history. But I was looking at it as I'm going to be the first woman on a council in a long time. And it didn't dawn on me until election night when a reporter asked me what that felt like to be the first person of color ever elected to the city of Cedar Woolley for any position.
So you didn't know. You didn't even know.
I had no idea.
What was your answer to that question?
I literally burst into tears. I didn't even have an answer. It didn't even hit me until just that moment, and I burst into tears. Luckily for me, I was standing next to another council member, and I just cried right into his shoulder. I was shocked, and I had my daughter with me, which was even more amazing. It was just shocking because at the time, I had lived there for about 11 years. I felt like I was like everyone else because that's just how I was treated. It's kind of funny being in Cedar Woolley. And I feel like a lot of people don't want to move to Cedar Woolley because they feel like it's too conservative and it's too closed off. And I never felt that. Matter of fact, I just love the way I'm treated in Cedar Woolley.
So, but what's the significance of that for you, being the first?
I'm hoping it opens the doors for others.
Well, let's get to wanting to be a Hillary Clinton delegate. You're a Hillary supporter. Why Hillary?
I absolutely adore Hillary. In 2008, I was not in Hillary's camp. I was more in Senator Obama's camp. But since then, I've been watching her career. I feel like she is just so qualified and so amazing on every level. As a women's rights advocate, there's just no way not to support her. And what she does for women, I mean, there's been lots of times where I've seen women have good ideas and men get the credit. And that's fine. But now it's time for us to notice that that's what's been happening and to maybe put women in more power positions. And what's better than the president of the United States?
Jermaine J. Cornegay is a city council member in Cedro Woolley. She's running to be a Hillary Clinton delegate from Washington State. I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
And you will find our earlier interview with an aspiring Bernie Sanders delegate at our website, KUOW.org. Hey, thank you for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Celebrity chefs are just about every place these days, but when I was a little kid, there were two. There was Julia Child, and there was a vivacious Englishman known as the Galloping Gourmet.
Made it. Thank you so much for being here. Bless your hearts. Hey, I've got a great dish for you, and it's a great lump of steak. A super dish. I'll show you where it comes from. It comes from England, comes from a place called Clifton, which is...
The Galloping Gourmet would literally gallop onto the set holding a glass of wine. I later found out his secret is he had cellophane holding the wine in. But anyway, the Galloping Gourmet was on in my house and many, many other TVs in the late 60s and early 70s. Well, the Galloping Gourmet himself, Graham Kerr, lives here in the Skagit Valley in Mount Vernon. He has been out of the celebrity chef game for a long time, but he's just written a memoir called Flash of Silver, where he compares his life to the journey of an animal that he has watched many times, a Chinook salmon.
I looked at that and thought to myself, here's something that gets burst in a certain place, comes downriver and experiences things that are new all the time, kind of like a childhood. Adolescence breaks out into the ocean of opportunity, released from family. Ooh, I can do my thing. I can eat anything and avoid being eaten. And then in this magical moment, rain falls on the mountains, the freshet of the fresh water picked up the scent of my birthplace, runs down, comes out of the Columbia River, and I sniff it and turn and come in with the tide, and then I begin to go upstream against the current of affairs or whatever that might be until I die. But in the death, I survive as a species. And I looked at that and I thought, if there isn't ever a perfect metaphor for people nowadays, it's that. By all means, we all have that rite of passage. We come down, we experience. We all get into the ocean of opportunity. Some of us have road signs that come up and say, whoa, just a moment, if you keep on doing this, it may not be a good idea. And when we get that, we make a turn. And that's turning back up that fresh river, if you like, and feeling a sense of invigoration by doing that, and a real potential of finishing one's life well. So that's the reason why.
It is a spectacular finish, a journey and a finish, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. And true. I have a friend who says that the chief purpose of life should be to prepare for a joyful death.
Mr. Kerr, the salmon's main job before spawning is to get fat. And I remember you on TV cooking with a lot of fat. But didn't you renounce that later?
Yes. Well, it's not renounce it so much as run head on into it. You know, sometimes you see some road signs which says slow down. And this is one of those. My wife Trina had a stroke and a heart attack, diabetes, hypertension. And you either find a cheap way of burying somebody or you actually try to keep them alive. Mm-hmm. And I tried the latter. And I had 28 wonderful years of pulling a U-turn and learning how to live differently. And I pulled a U-turn of 180, not 360. Some people pull U-turns and keep going.
And 360 and go the same direction?
They're going in exactly the same direction. It's very hard to make changes. Mm. And I guess my purpose behind the book altogether is that some people would join me in this wonderful upstream life and find ways for themselves to be able to change their habits that they want to change. That's, for me, if I could ever have a wonderful ending to my life, it would be that.
We're talking with Graham Kerr, who you know as the Galloping Gourmet. I'd like to talk about how we stay connected with food and nature.
Yeah.
Since it was you and Julia Child, our TV is now full of chefs. I mean,
178, my last
178. Check. Yeah. Wow. There's plenty of attention to how we eat. But what do you think it has done to the way we eat?
We have adapted to speed in the way that we eat. We feed at speed. And the result of that is that truly, we're from one meal to another, we will gulp it down. And quite often, unfortunately, we will have media at the same time. So we're not really paying much attention to it. And the cook who has to cook for a person who's not paying much attention hasn't got much of an audience. And so the result is that a tendency to veer towards doing less labor because it isn't a rewarding enough experience. In France, a good chicken can be brought home and cooked lovingly, and the husband coming back from work, my darling, this is so wonderful. You are the most perfect cook in all the world. Now, a woman like that gets that kind of response. It's fun. And it's wonderful. It's rewarding. But the guy who sits down in a lazy, you know, whatever, boy chair, mm-hmm. and pulls a lever and gets out a six-pack, having had his gut stretched and was watching ESPN, there's no real reason for a person doing that. And to a large extent, unless we've come from another country recently, the chances are that we give up that oasis of opportunity of real life and relationship over a table. We give it up for some kind of listening to whatever Trump is doing at the same time as we're eating something that somebody has prepared for me to nourish me. And that's what I used to say to my darling. I want to nourish you and I want to delight you. And I want to be able to relate to you over the table. I don't want to listen even to NPR, when we are eating together. And we did that, and I love that. And now that she's gone, I eat with NPR. But I'm paying attention to what I cook for myself.
So there's a change to be made. There's an opportunity there.
Yes.
And you write about how the salmon can do that epic 180 instead of a 360 and go in the same direction. Mm-hmm. How can we make change?
In the past, as the Galloping Gourmet, I was known as the high priest of hedonism.
Yeah.
All right. And they
were also eat if it tastes good, smells good, eat it, and then drink a lot of wine afterwards.
Exactly right. And I loved every moment of it. Please understand. Somebody says, don't you regret what you used to do? And I say, no, I did it with my whole heart. I did. But having said that, I got the award, the Broken Wooden Spoon Award, which was given by Weight Watchers International for the most dangerous man alive for people who wanted to be well. Hmm. So you come from there and you pull this U-turn and you go to a man who wants to cook for his family and care for them. That is an amazing change, because from full fat, full on gourmet, great wines, you know, come on, let's live whilst we've got the chance, to this business. Let's live a little longer and let's live a little stronger. And let's do that by being a little careful on the way we do that. That does not sell, my friend. There is a great difference between the galloping gourmet and who I am now. And I'm perfectly happy with that, because I am living what I am talking about. Now, I used to live what I talked about, and I found I had a wife who had a stroke and a heart attack and diabetes and hypertension. There is an end game to excess, right? And there is an end game to being nourished and cared for. And I know that it's possible to delight people, not at the same level, not at a lust level. That's a strong desire of the flesh, desires certain things, really. I'm not going to mention what they are, because then that becomes legalism. Mm. And I don't want that. But I just know there's some things. I've got to have another one of those. This has gone out of my life. We eat to be nourished. And I love the thought of cooking for other people in the same way and helping other people to see that. It's a great, great way to finish a career.
Graham Kerr was famous as the galloping gourmet on public television. His new memoir is called Flash of Silver, and it is about pulling that U-turn 180 degrees and confronting your challenges swimming upstream to finish your journey. When he walked into our studio and we met, Graham Kerr handed me a piece of paper containing his typed-out statement of life purpose, like a personal mission statement. And it ends with these words: when purpose becomes a central reason for staying alive, then personal resilience becomes more important, and we seek to do less harm to ourselves, those we love, and indeed to the planet we all share. This resilience seeking change is what I have called upstreaming. It is my purpose for staying alive. Graham Kerr, May 2016. Skagit Valley resident Graham Kerr, that is the mission of the 82-year-old former galloping gourmet. And you can hear more from him tonight, because he's in Seattle. He's going to be at the University Bookstore this evening at 7 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Here you are living in an area so rich in the arts, but that doesn't mean you know which work might speak to you. KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman introduces you to one artist you ought to know about.
Do you remember the first movie you really loved? Beth Barrett does.
I had just gotten my driver's license, and I drove to the cinema in Wheaton, Illinois.
And that's where she saw The Killing Fields. It was 1984. Since then, Barrett has seen thousands of movies. As director of programming for the Seattle International Film Festival, she oversees what we watch there every year. Barrett calls Seattle a movie mecca, and not just because it rains a lot.
I think that people in Seattle are by nature interested in things going on around them. We spend a lot of time internally thinking about things.
For Barrett, movies provide fodder for deep thoughts. Every time a filmmaker tells an old story in a new way, she finds a little magic.
You never know when it's going to happen, and you never know if that film that you looked at that went, is going to be the one that actually changes your life.
Beth Barrett's business is to conjure those life-changing moments, and she loves it. That's The Art of Our City. From Seattle Center, I'm Marcy Silman.
Arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman and her series, Art of Our City, introduces you to artists you ought to know about. You will find photos, you'll find video for all of Marcy's art stories at KUOW.org and on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. Just look for the hashtag, Art of Our City. And here's one of the films showing at SIFF right now. 5 years ago, Seattle's Union Gospel Mission brought on a former Army Ranger named Mike Johnson and came up with a bold idea to help homeless people who are addicted to drugs climb Mount Rainier. The thinking was, if addicts can climb that mountain, they can climb out of addiction. KUOW's Jeannie Yandel talked with one of the first women to try the climb. Dawn Brown's story is told in that documentary called A New High.
I am Dawn. I am strong. I am Dawn. I am strong. I am Dawn.
Okay, a huge grin spread across your face when you heard that just now. What was going through your mind at that moment?
Oh my gosh, that was the hardest thing I had ever done. And I don't know, I was so ready to give up. And if it wasn't, for Mike behind me and the others, oh my gosh, the team just encouraging me to push on. That was like, I have never been through anything as hard as that was. I don't know how to say. It's just, it's a wonderful memory. It's a wonderful memory.
When on the mountain, though, did you not feel like you could keep going? When did you not feel like, I am Dawn, I am strong?
There was lots of different times. Oh, my God. I probably wouldn't have... Like I said, I would have never made it. I mean, those voices were in there from the very beginning saying, you can't do this. And, you know, in my addiction and everything, I had reclused myself to me by myself 24/7 and pretty much, you know, in oblivion. And I guess it's like each triumph, each time I made it, I, you know, and started trusting my team members more. Being a part of the team, you know, it just started taking hold. And then I was like, this is my good thing. I'm going to do this. This is, you know, the first really major positive thing in my life since I had gotten sober that, yeah, it was like, I am going to do this.
I'm talking with Dawn Brown, and she was part of a local climbing group along with other homeless people who were staying at the Union Gospel Mission here in Seattle who went up Mount Rainier. And her experience was chronicled in a documentary called A New High. And Dawn, we have another clip from the film that we'd like to play you. This clip is actually you talking about the program after you finished.
Doing this climb has just made me feel so much better about myself and confidence. And I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how to put it into words. It has just helped me so much. And these people who believe in you, I mean, where else do you have people give you that kind of support?
It makes you believe, finally believe in yourself.
Time to do some work.
Now I'm going to cry.
Yeah, I'm coming.
You're nodding as you hear yourself talk about that experience.
I know. Yeah. Oh, my God. It's still, I just remember that was like deep down. That was from the heart. Oh, my gosh. This experience just changed me so much. And just to have the outpour of love and support from all these people. And, you know, I didn't even know them, you know, and it just changed. I'm changed. I am so changed today from all this.
Dawn, as we've been talking several times, you've brought up the rest of the team that went up Mount Rainier with you. Why were those relationships so important to you being able to do this thing?
You know, one of the things we learned early on is treating each other with respect. And for me and some of my past relationships with men, I mean, there was a lot of verbal abuse. There could be physical abuse, you know, name calling, just awful things. And, you know, there wasn't to be treated by men with respect was a new thing for me. And for them to want to help me and not be trying to get something in return, or me feeling like because somebody did something for me, I needed to give that in return. That was huge. That was huge. And that has affected my relationships today. And those are all things that I learned from that climbing team.
This is quite a journey.
Yeah.
Just talking about where you were versus where you are now and how this experience helped get you here. Yeah. So what does that mean to you? What does it mean to you to be able to say to those doubting voices in your head, you're wrong. I can totally do this.
Oh, my God. The freedom in life. I have had more life in these last 3 years than, you know, of course, I was raising my children before and everything, but it's certainly during the addiction and everything, you're just in this little tiny hole, you know, nothing. And today, my life is so big. I don't know. It's just so big. And it's full of so much love. That's the thing. It's full of so much love. I was so all by myself. That's the best thing I can say.
Dawn Brown was part of a program at Seattle's Union Gospel Mission that takes homeless addicts up Mount Rainier. She talked about it with Jeannie Yanda last year. That documentary, A New High, will show at SIFF, the Seattle International Film Festival, when the festival opens next Thursday, May 19th. We're tweeting out a link to the trailer and the film showtimes for you at KUOW. We're turning the page toward the end of another episode of KOW's The Record, kind of like when you're coming toward the end of a favorite book. What are you going to do when that book ends? Well, here's a recommendation from Nancy Pearl with Marcy Silman.
I know we're not quite in summer, but as we inch towards Memorial Day, it has me looking for books that I'm just going to dive into. And you've brought one in today that I hope might be the pool of my dreams.
Well, I hope you like this book, too, because I have to say it's truly one of my 10 favorite novels.
Wow.
And it's by a woman named Paulette Giles. Her third novel, which is the one I want you to read, Marcy, is called The Color of Lightning. And it's a historical novel set in Texas in the years after the Civil War. And the main character, who is a real person, is named Britt Johnson. He's African American. He's a freed slave. He moves with his former owner and brings his family to Texas to homestead.
So that part is true.
That part is true. Plus some other parts. But we know very little about Britt Johnson. What Paulette Giles has done in this book is offer us a picture of that very morally complex period in American history when you had the freed slaves and you had the Native Americans whom the government was trying to literally corral and try to turn into farmers. Because the Indians were hunted by the army, they have taken to raiding and kidnapping settlers' families. And that's what happens to Britt Johnson's family.
It's an interesting choice. Paulette Giles could have written nonfiction about this, I would imagine. There's a lot been written. It's interesting that she made that choice to write a novel about this.
Well, I don't think there's enough known about Britt Johnson that would satisfy a nonfiction reader. I don't think you could write a biography, but you can sure write an amazing novel, because what Britt Johnson does after his wife and daughter are captured is he goes after them. And this is the story of that search for his wife and child. And Britt Johnson became the subject of another novel by Alan LeMay, which is called The Searchers, which was then turned into the movie that through Hollywood weirdness and casting decisions, John Wayne became Britt Johnson. It's a book that brings this whole period when it's hard to know who's right and who's wrong and who to root for. And all of that is in this book. And the best part is that this October, she has written not exactly a sequel, but a novel set at the same time period in which Britt Johnson is a minor character in the new one.
So it's a good time to read one, then the new one coming out in October.
Yes.
The author is Paulette Giles. The book is Color of Lightning, and Nancy Pearl is our reviewer. Once again, thank you.
Thank you, Marcy.
Nancy Pearl talking with KUOW's Marcy Silman, and of course you can find all of Nancy's picks at our website, KUOW.org. Visit us there on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. We live tweet to you at KUOW. We had quite a conversation this last hour about The Galloping Gourmet. Memories, and remember, he's going to be talking to you if you want to drop by at the University Bookstore in Seattle, Graham Kerr, 7 o'clock tonight. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW.